Good morning, everyone. This is a special day in the history of our university, and I hope everyone is ready to have a full day of activities as we have our investiture later on today. Certainly the weather is cooperating, which is nice. I think it'll be a special outdoor ceremony. We have our committee meetings today, and first on the agenda is our Finance and Budget Committee, and I think they have quite a bit of information they want to share with us today and talk about. So with that, Regent Johnson, I'll turn things over to you.
Thanks, Philip. And I'll let you begin.
I'm standing as I allow folks that are handling the first agenda item to come up. Let me introduce Randy McGill, I believe the associate athletic director for Mrs. Grayson. He prepared our first report that you'll accept, which is the agreed upon procedures relating to NCAA compliance. And Brad Shelley. And Brad is senior manager with Pearl Forward. So these are two individuals that know the insides and outsides of this report, and I'll let them give you some brief overview and answer your questions.
All right. And before we begin, I think probably according to proper procedure, this is the first action item, FB1, in the materials that were sent out previously. And from the committee, I'll ask if there is a motion for the acceptance of the NCAA agreed upon procedures report for the year ended June 30, 2017.
So moved.
Second. I have a motion from Regent Higman and second from Regent Kennedy. Any discussions? Or I'll turn it over to you and let you start, and the committee can.
All right. Thank you very much. Good morning. Glad to be here. As Ann mentioned, my name is Brad Shelley with Pearl Boardwalk. We are the independent auditors for the university, so we combine the audit of the financial statements and then some other reports. And one of the other reports we do is the independent accountants report, which is an agreed upon procedures report, which I believe you have. This is a report that we do every year, required by the NCAA, to be done annually for all Division I universities. And so it's just going through procedures they have outlined, looking at both the revenues and expenses. So we won't spend a lot of time going through this, but please do, if you have questions, stop me and I'll try to answer those the best I can. On pages 2 and 3 are the schedule of revenue and expenses. Again, this is for the year ended June 30, 2017, so this past fiscal year. Page 2 is the revenues. Page 3 is the expenses, and this is, again, according to the NCAA guidelines, listing out all the revenues by the major sports, and then your expenses on page 3. So that's the schedule that we're looking at, and that's the schedule of all the procedures are used. We do have a number of procedures. As I mentioned, these are all required by the NCAA. There are 48 procedures related to revenue, 65 procedures related to expenses, and about 15 additional procedures. The Hackard report that very little exceptions noted, so going through the many pages here, I'm not going to read through all these procedures. Most of them do say no exceptions noted or the procedure was not applicable. Just a couple of exceptions were noted in here, and those were not significant either. So on page 11, on procedure 44 related to revenue, we just noted that there were a couple of transactions that were classified differently, still classified as revenue, but just classified on a different line, so no real effect there. It's something that we noted throughout our testing. And then on page 20, the first additional procedure, which was looking at the financial reporting system and looking at the NCAA membership database, so it's comparing financial aid to what is reported by the NCAA. And we noted some differences there that I think in talking with management, believe those to be just timing differences in what was reported on one student by the NCAA versus in the financial aid office. So, again, noting those differences there, but we did not consider those to be material or significant. Those are the only two exceptions that we noted throughout all the procedures. So, happy to answer any other questions anybody has.
I don't have a specific question, but I'll turn it over to some committee. Jason? Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Ready?
David? Anybody else?
I have a couple questions. And so my first question is, I'm looking at page 24. So I'm wondering, between the this year and the prior year, obviously there has been some reclassification taking place, involving quite a large amount of dollars. And I wonder, so my first question is, can you elaborate on what that exactly is? And then the second question is, the student fees you reported do not agree with the student fees we report. Okay? It's basically not even close. So just to give you an example, we disclosed that our athletic fee is $218 per semester. And obviously, 9,200-something students would raise the revenue you disclosed here as a student fee. And our enrollment is much higher. So why is there this discrepancy?
The student fees as collected are split two-thirds and one-third. Two-thirds actually come to athletics. So when you look at the budgeted number, this year it happens to be $6,024,000. We actually receive, and within our operating working papers, two-thirds of that $6 million, roughly $4 million. That's what actually comes to us. The remainder of that goes towards some debt service that we have, which is captured in a different line item on this report. The debt service for Dale Memorial.
Okay. What's the reason for doing it this way?
That predates me. This, the way it has been done since I've been here for the last 2 years.
But it is misleading. I mean, there's no question about that.
I'm not sure that if he just explained where it is and how it's broken down, I can't see where that's misleading.
Well, when we disclose on our fact page that our revenue for student fees to athletics should be 50% higher than listed in this report. That is misleading. Sorry.
To who?
Somebody looking at these numbers.
But if it has an audit trail and it is explained, if it goes to debt service, and debt services has to be classified in a different way due to the uniform chart of accounts, that isn't misleading. That's transparent.
That maybe your opinion, yes.
Well, I think we need to be cautious about how we accuse someone of doing something. Saying something is misleading is an accusation.
Okay, I withdraw that statement.
Let me just clarify. The line is student fees. It's not categorized as the athletic fee in its entirety. So what's reported is the amount that is direct support collected through athletics. The remaining student fee, in fact, is recorded from a different perspective in our financial reports, different from NCAA, and the rest of the mandatory athletic fee is shown, but it is also in this process a line that it is university central money that supports the lease payment where the lease is. So it's split. I'm not sure that NCAA has, much like our financial reports, we have 12 to 15 notes that are clarifying points. I'm not sure the NCAA even allows us to have footnotes to the agreed-upon procedures.
So this report is basically for the NCAA, and not necessarily for all universities here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
And just to clarify, it matches what the NCAA procedures require. I mean, that's your role, is it not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Yeah, so we're only looking at what the NCAA requires. And again, we're looking at that audit trail to see that we collected student fees of X amount and that the portion is two-thirds of it is going here, the other third is going to debt service.
So would it be fair to say in no way are we trying to mislead anyone?
I would think that's fair to say.
Yeah. Thank you.
John, I apologize. I skipped up here. I didn't mean to.
That's okay. Meaning that I'm on the committee.
Yes.
Thank
I'm sorry. Because all the committee members are here, so I apologize.
Thank you, John.
Anything else regarding these procedures?
The question about this reclassification has not been addressed.
Question about what?
So, for example, here we report, the direct institutional report rose from 9.7 million to 13.4 million. And there got to be a reason for changing a number that drastically.
And finally, this is kind of a misleading line item. If you refer back to page 2 and page 3, on page 2, the revenue side, the revenue statement, you'll notice that in the non-program specific, there are several lines. I'll start with the NCAA distribution, conference distributions, program novelty parking, and so forth sales. Those are all received at the department level and not reported or not received at a team-specific level. So when we actually, the department, receive revenue in this way, the report requires every team to be balanced and so forth. So when you follow that down through on page 3, the very bottom line, of total operating expense, excess, deficiency, and so forth, to get that number to zero, the transfer back comes from that revenue. So that being discussed, the direct institutional support for athletics really is financial aid and benefits, payroll benefits, the $9 million. Past practice has been to attempt to allocate student fees down per sport. As I worked through this and spoke with the auditor, we felt that this was an inaccurate reporting for student fees. You're concerned about how much we collected and so forth. We collect that at the department level, not the football, basketballs, and so forth. So we reported this year the student fees as a department-level revenue as compared to years past allocating it to the football team and so forth. We felt that that was inaccurate. So in doing so this year, that's what has inflated or appeared to inflate the direct institutional support on the revenue, direct revenue side. The offset to that is the negative or the reduction of $3 million for the allocation from department revenues to the teams. There was no transfer from athletics to the university. The transfer was from the athletics on this report only to the football team, basketball teams, and so forth. If you look year over year, the direct institutional support that athletics did receive, it's roughly within $480,000, and that's why. It's a direct result of increased labor costs and increased financial aid costs. It's just a reporting.
Okay. So your anticipation would be in the future this would be more consistent?
This would be very consistent.
Thank you.
Anything further? Hearing nothing, I'll ask the committee members who are in favor of the motion to signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion carries FB1. We'll now go to FB2. Thank you. I appreciate it very much. go to FD2, which is the acceptance of the third quarter statement of revenues and expenditures. Procedurally again, I'll ask for a motion to approve action item FD number 2. Jason, motion second.
Second.
David, second. Ann?
Yes, sir. So you have the revenue and expenditures as of the end of March 2018. In comparison to a year ago, we're tracking reasonably close to what you would expect. The only differences are pointed out in budgetary implications, where consistent with previous reports to the board, we anticipate that the central tuition accrued from fall and spring is still coming in at approximately $3.9 million off the budget. We expect that to vary now at this point, and that which accounts for 2.4% of the budgeted fall and spring revenue. We have the ability to cover this shortfall from carry forward, and as you'll hear in presentation coming up in May, we have identified ways to balance our budget moving forward as it relates to the current year shortfall. What I should have added under the budgetary implications was that the state has in fact cut our funding by $746,500, 1%, and that did show up in third quarter. And again, that amount is covered by unallocated carry forward. May I answer any questions?
Yeah. So, look, Fanny, excuse me. I want to ask, hold that thought. Okay, please. And I'll start with John this time since I excluded John. Any questions? Andy, I'm sorry.
So what accounts for the $3.9 million discrepancy? Is it simply decreased your role?
Exactly. We have a decline in enrollment for fall and spring compared to budget. We did budget for a shortfall, but we came in about 2% off of budget on that one.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. And I'm glad you added. We did budget for a shortfall. Didn't budget.
We budgeted about $4.5 million. However, that wasn't the final number either. So. A little crystal ball trying to figure out what students are going to do. And we're going to be even more conservative going into FY19.
Thank you. Just a little quick clarification.
Yes,
I'm sorry. I was about half listening. I read the numbers, but you just said that we had budgeted 4.5 and we were short 9. That's not a gross of 13 million. 9 and 4.
Yes.
It's 13 million.
I'm sorry. We're talking about 4 million short here over the budget. We reduced the budget about 4.5, so it's about 9.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Wanted to clarify.
The combination of the two.
So the two is 9.8. 9 plus the 4.
No.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else?
When I looked at this on page F3, I first sort of was a little confused about the first column, which is the revised budget third quarter. I was wondering if in future reports that could be changed because it is the revised annual budget.
Right.
And not the third quarter budget.
We'll make that change. Yeah, I think that's been pointed out, and we missed this one. It is in fact our annual budget that has been revised this year, but we don't budget by quarter.
And what is the percent shortfall that we might be looking for next year, especially with the change in admission standards? Are you referencing conservative?
I don't have that readily available, but
okay.
I will in May.
All right, thank you.
So I'd rather not.
Oh, I understand.
Throw out a number and come back and say if we have calculated it, and I'll come back to you in May.
Thank you.
Anything further? Hearing nothing, I'll ask the committee members if they have the motion to signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion carried unanimously, so it's FB number 2, and we go to the last action item, FB number 3, which is our approval of personnel actions. This has been presented to everybody last week in the meeting. It appears on the various pages F1 through F12 and S1 through S9 relating to the staff. So I will entertain a motion for approval of personnel actions.
So moved.
Ready? Second.
Second.
David. Ian.
All I have to point out on this one that consistent with what Fred, we're pleased to bring the promotion and tenure recommendations forward for your approval.
And yes. I'll start with the committee. David. Jason. Fred. John. Anybody else? Hearing no other questions or comments, I will ask committee members in favor of this motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion carries. That's all the action items we have on this committee meeting. We now have some informational items, and we'll start with resource allocation management and planning, new budget model.
Looking around for our peer I consultant. Don't tell me I'm doing this presentation.
I knew you wouldn't let me down. I told him what time to be here, and we were rocking and rolling. I thought, oh, I'm going to have to sing for you, and that will be really scary. All right, so our first presentation, we'll have a couple today. The resource allocation, management, and planning, which we have used the acronym of RAMP. The Huron Consultants contract started in January. The steering committee has been meeting. It's been an intense process, a very important process. However, we're probably, I don't know if I want to say halfway there, maybe a little than halfway there. I'll add that yesterday we met with a joint meeting of the Budget Council and the University Senate Finance and Budget Committee. There's other stakeholder meetings that are occurring. And it's very important that the campus feel engaged in this process and understand how this will impact future decisions at what level. There's a lot to be done, but what we wanted to do today is to allow the board to get into a little more detail as to how this is being developed without getting too far down into the weeds. One reason we're not presenting the model is that we're still engaging the deans. We need to engage the provost, a handful of new deans, so this is definitely a work in progress. So Matt Smith is here today with the Huron Consulting Project Director, and I'm going to let him walk you through this overview of the model.
And if I, well, we're getting ready here, let me reemphasize something I think you referred to. This is the 30,000 foot view. And it's intended to provide the board and committee members with who Huron is, what our goal is, how they're going about accomplishing it, not necessarily the detail.
Good morning.
Morning.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the board about resource allocation management and planning. As Ann said, my name is Matt Smith. I'm a director at Huron Consulting Group. I've been with Huron for about 6 years in their strategy and operations group, primarily focused on budget and finance-related engagements at a number of universities around the country, both private, public, large and small. So just appreciate the opportunity to speak to you a little bit about budgeting as a whole, as it relates to kind of colleges and universities. I understand that I have about 15 minutes to speak, and so I've broken my presentation into two components, the first of which kind of talks up front about just some industry trends in terms of colleges and schools and how they're thinking about allocating resources across the campus. And then from there, I'll transition and talk a bit about the project specifically at WKU, some of the guiding principles, timelines, objectives, things like that. So with that,
we're working on it. technology there.
Yeah, he's working on it.
Oh, well,
there. That was a great presentation.
Any questions?
All right, so as I indicated, the first piece I'll just talk a little bit about is kind of an overview of the industry. So this slide speaks to some of the recent trends within budgeting. A number of institutions have recently decided to undertake a redesign of their budget models, in large part to find long-term solutions to recent financial challenges. And so we talk about how institutions are working diligently to reframe the way they think about budgeting, oftentimes as a way to develop revenues, to promote certain types of behaviors, to funnel resources to strategic priorities. The second bullet then speaks to this a recent survey that was done just a few years back by Inside Higher Ed. It found that nearly half of U.S. institutions had changed their budget model in the past 4 years, and for those that hadn't, about a third planned to do so. Of those, nearly a quarter have transitioned to what's called responsibility-centered management. It's a form of incentive-based budgeting. It's kind of a more decentralized approach where you provide more incentives kind of for local units amongst the teams and research units and the like. Third point here, the recent changes have often resulted in more inclusive strategies, so broader stakeholder groups are involved in the budgeting process, so it makes for a more robust annual planning process throughout the year. It's really an attempt to better integrate academic planning with financial management. With this inclusiveness, universities have often required investment in data analytics and reporting, particularly in those budget models that use certain types of metrics like credit hours or student headcounts or things and the like to kind of allocate certain resources. Ultimately, universities are adopting kind of hybrid models where they're kind of cherry-picking different aspects of different models in order to customize a model that's unique to their institution's particular culture, value, strengths, and so forth. This next slide just provides kind of an overview and illustrates the fact that an increasing number of institutions have chosen to redesign their budget model, particularly those since the Great Recession, as more fiscal pressures have been placed upon universities, particularly public universities, as it relates to state or campus operations. So you see that line there that kind of indicates the Great Recession and kind of a significant uptick there post-2009 in terms of universities redesigning their models. The vast majority of these institutions have gone towards some form of decentralized incentive-based budgeting, kind of moving away from a cost-focused kind of approach to budgeting and more that incents teams to be able to identify new opportunities to grow revenues through more research, establishing new academic programs, growing existing ones, etc. This next slide just kind of speaks to some of the benefits of effective resource allocation. Some of the reasons that those institutions we looked at on the prior slide are moving towards incentive-based budgeting. The first point here is that it facilitates two-way discussions. So as I mentioned before, kind of a more robust annual planning process. Oftentimes that involves academic affairs and financial management working together at the outset of the fiscal year and then having regular conversations throughout. That's a pretty stark contrast to kind of more centralized kind of command and control budget models where most of the budget activity happens in just a few months kind of leading up to the beginning of the new fiscal year. Second point here is we talk about how the resource allocation translates strategic goals into management and operating plans. So goals are realized in part by allocating resources to promote certain behaviors that help to achieve those strategic goals. We often find that policies and procedures are reevaluated to ensure that they're aligned with where the institution wants to go and its evolving mission and strategic priorities. The fourth point here is improve the effectiveness of incentives with the potential to create win-win opportunities across an entire institution. So a budget model by itself does not create or destroy wealth, but the hope is to put in place a set of parameters and incentives such that over the long haul, there's an opportunity to grow the pie as it relates to new revenue streams, and in part that all kind of campus units get benefit. This next point down talks about, identifies the true nature of internal subsidies. The economic reality of colleges and universities is such that there's levels of kind of cross-subsidization that happen throughout campus. There are certain things that happen on campus that are core to the mission of the institution, core to the WKU student experience that by their nature are not self-funding. So there's a need for central investment to invest in those things that make WKU what it is. And then finally, we talk about, in large part, a move towards effective resource allocation as a move away from incremental budgeting, which really fails to evaluate the basic budget allocations. This incremental budgeting type of approach is a historical model whereby the budgets that campus units receive oftentimes is based on decisions that maybe were made decades ago and in large part oftentimes kind of lost to history. So there's with this move towards more decentralized budgeting, you're trying to kind of better capture the current economics of the university and set a different set of behaviors moving forward.
I want to make a comment too. This is really good and important stuff, and it takes longer than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
This is worth our time listening to. So.
Great.
Well, this is some, it's new information to some, and then it's pretty understood to others. However, in your experience, this, if I may use a term of phantom knowledge we really don't understand, when you talk about focusing resources to areas that do not have an immediate impact or can be categorized in a certain area, well, how do you use a metric around that to determine that phantom benefit? For example, if we get, our debate team, our forensics team, national award winner, how do we know that that gets national recognition, and we all know that happens, and we can dedicate more resources, because that's not a self-funding. I mean, we're not charging tickets.
That's right.
We can't audit a ticket trail to go into that, but that's a very big expense. Those students fly to various places. Someone would say, oh, that's a luxury to be able to fly to Boston to debate against Harvard or someone. But how do you put a metric against something like that? Because that transcends the entire university.
Right.
So how can we effectively do that without criticism? Yeah. That's the other thing.
That's a great point. I mean, there are, and this inherent in a lot of these incentive-based models is there is a, there's a central steering mechanism that leadership can kind of make some of those investments, given the reality that you can't have a model that just outlines all resources based on metrics alone, such that you have kind of this a market-driven approach that does not kind of place value, again, at things that are not by their nature self-funding. So a good example is a couple of weeks ago I was working at a public institution, a flagship, as a school of music, and the university is incredibly proud of the school of music. It's a real proud of it. But schools of music tend to be fairly costly structures because you have a tenured professor, and he or she may be teaching just three or four students. That's pedagogically kind of sound, but that's an expensive endeavor. But the university is values it greatly, and so as a result, makes kind of central investment into that school such that it kind of supports itself.
So if you don't mind that you expand then if that is true, then the core mission of the university should define those areas.
Correct.
In its mission statement or a subset of the mission statement, that this is a focus that we have. So it's clear to all stakeholders that that's important.
That's right. And oftentimes a resource allocation model is an articulation of the mission and the priorities of the university. And the model should be adaptable such that as priorities evolve over time, the model can adapt to those changing priorities as well as just the changing kind of financial conditions of the university.
Well, the chairman pointed out that's more of the ICIP mission, and he actually corrected me, he's right. It's the strategic plan of how we go about it.
Yeah.
So then my last comment is, would you agree or disagree that then this effective resource allocation at some point cannot just be defined as a science, but there's an art to it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And we need to be sensitive to that. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
As an aside, it's probably not a coincidence. I know University of Southern California was the first university on your chart. And I think Stephen Sample was president then. He was very famous president. But they did change that university from a good university to a real powerhouse. And it's probably not a coincidence that they went through this process 35 years ago.
One of my mentors was John Curry. I believe he was chief financial officer.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So
this next section here, we'll talk about kind of translate what I've been talking about in terms of the industry-wide to the project here at Western University. So these are the project goals that were established at the outset of the project at the beginning of this calendar year. The primary goal is to develop a performance or incentive-based model that will address the following desires. The first of which is to align with the state's funding formula to better position the university to increase state funding. Second piece is to address current financial trends and to put in place incentives that can help to drive student enrollment growth through research enterprise. Third piece is to, we were talking just a moment ago, allocating funds in a way that will support the university's strategic plan. Also rewarding performance and investing in strategic priorities in an equitable manner. And then finally, and this can't be overstated, increasing transparency and simplicity of resource allocation. So transparency in the sense of helping the campus community understand all the inflows and outflows of the university's financials. But moreover, also having a model that's that balances kind of precision with simplicity. Some universities in the past have made the mistake of going too far down the path of like a cost accounting model. I'll give you an example of a university. I won't name it, but they had created a model under by themselves, and I believe the manual to understand the model was about 125 pages long, about three people on campus. And as a result, it just it led to indecision because people couldn't understand it, and so they didn't really understand what were the incentives, and that's not an effective model. So you want to kind of balance those ideas of precision and simplicity such that you need a model that where people clearly understand the incentives and then can act accordingly. So that's these are all things that are kind of regularly being contemplated as we engage with things.
Yeah, I want to point something out that's more of a comment as opposed to a question, but bullet point one is aligned with state funding formula, and then bullet point four is reward performance and investment and strategy. To identify on performance, in common with a lot of our state formal funding, will be a performance base that's actually established by the General Assembly. Is that aligning with both of those bullet points, or first one? Or
it is, and one of the things that the steering committee has been thinking about, and as I understand it, as part of the state's performance funding formula, there's a student success metric.
Correct.
Around bachelor's degrees awarded. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the committee is considering. All right, how do we kind of incent that type of behavior where those academic units that can help kind of drive those bachelor's degrees completion rates can be rewarded accordingly? This next slide speaks to the project guiding principles. So at the outset of the project in January, we met with the steering committee, talked about the importance of principles to kind of govern the development of a new model. Each of the committee members submitted a list of 4 to 5 guiding principles. We kind of captured that, looked for common themes, aggregated it, and then kind of shared a working draft back with them. And then we kind of iterated on that back and forth over a few meetings. And this is really the kind of current draft of those principles, which I think is a good set of principles and representative of what I've seen at other institutions. And so I'll kind of lightly touch on each one of these. I know there's a lot of text up here on the slide, but one is to create a clear link between resource allocation and the university's mission, its priorities, and its commitment to student success, so drawing a stronger relationship between those ideas. As I mentioned previously, the importance of having a model that's flexible and can adapt and respond to changing conditions. It's not just a static model that's put in place and is never reevaluated over time. A consistent and predictable methodology for revenue and cost allocation that's easy to understand and features the incentives that we've been talking about is also a core principle of the steering. Promoting a collaborative and sustainable budgeting process, one that promotes transparency, efficiency, and accountability is also key. This is a collaborative and sustainable process across kind of all academic and administrative leaders around the institution. A holistic approach to budgeting that reflects a shared commitment to the fiscal health, that we're better together. This isn't some kind of what some universities have done is kind of this every tub on its own bottom kind of model. This is a model where units are kind of working together to help kind of in concert move the institution forward. And then finally, we talked about the importance of good data that's readily available, trusted, timely, et cetera. And so particularly institutions that are moving towards an incentive-based model, there's much more of a draw on data, not just financial data as it relates to revenues and expenses, but also institutional metrics that might be used to incent certain types of behavior. So that could be square footage, student headcount, employee headcount, credit hours, degrees awarded, those types of things. And so deans and their teams need that information kind of at their fingertips to be able to understand and kind of develop their operational plans and monitor the progress against those plans. Sir?
You know, this is really good, and we need this. But my question, again, I'm relying on your experience, since you've had this with other universities. Is there an opportunity for micromanagement of one department over another to be critical of the decision-making process, shared vision, and going forward? But, you know, we all have our own interests sometimes, and one department might feel they're more important than others. And how do you overcome that? How do you bring everyone to the focus that the mission is the most important and not your individual department or your... You see what I mean? If you're sharing a lot of data, somebody can be very critical of what you're spending the money on. So how do you overcome that? Is that the art part? Or?
Well, there's a couple pieces to that. I think one is that oftentimes with this this decentralized approach to budgeting, not only are you kind of, you're giving more of the local units kind of authority over the revenue that they earn, but with that responsibility. And so oftentimes in these types of incentive models, deans now have some more control to kind of shape their destiny, but they're still accountable for, you know, spending within their means. And so the thinking behind these decentralized models is the folks that are kind of closer to the action at the local level are better positioned to make choices that are in the best interest of their students and the colleges and schools' missions. But again, there's with the transparency comes accountability to ensure that deans are, again, living within their means and making decisions that are consistent with the strategic priorities of the university. That steering mechanism that I talked about before helps to incent those types of behaviors, knowing that there's oftentimes kind of some money available at the center to invest in strategic priorities. Deans have the ability to kind of submit proposals and plans for that, and to the extent that they're in line with strategic priorities, they can be given dollars to fund certain activities. And so that helps to kind of balance this central and local roles that we talked about, giving more responsibility and authority to local units, but also ensuring the behaviors that they're involved in help the institution as a whole, and not, sending different schools and colleges in different paths that kind of don't help the university as a collective move the way that it wants to move.
So that as it goes back up the flow, it does match with what the chairman was saying, that it matches with the performance model of the state.
That's right.
And the competition is more of, instead of critical, it's more healthy.
Yeah, and I think with the transparency also comes more collaboration, because now all of the budgeting decisions don't happen behind the curtain, kind of in the black box, and people don't really quite understand why we are getting the funding that we're getting, except that, well, it's kind of what we got last year plus some change at the margins. Now there's more transparency. I've heard a number of deans talk at other institutions that now that there's transparency, I understand how I can better collaborate with my colleagues across the street to create new programs, and we understand how revenue flows accordingly. So that frees us up to be able to work together. In the old incremental model, we could do things together, and it might be the right thing for their respective schools and the institutions, but we don't understand how the financials work, and we feel as if we might have to incur that cost upon ourselves, and that can be a disincentive for people. You might want to grow your program, but and you know you're helping the university grow revenues as a result of more students coming on, but you're not directly benefiting from that. You're not, even though you're incurring the cost that might be associated with new programs. And so that can provide a set of disincentives to want to grow programs. And these decentralized models, that stronger relationship between those ideas of revenue generation and distribution frees up deans to want to work better together.
I want to emphasize something, and it's really important. This is not a comment, it's a comment, not a question. We have taken a completely new attitude here about how we approach things in this university and share the other stuff down. This is an excellent example of moving in that direction, Mr. President.
You've actually described the sunrise. I mean, you've told us what it's going to look like and how it works. So we appreciate that, and this work that you've done certainly is a different direction. We do think this will be very beneficial for the future.
I think Andy raised her hand first.
Yes. I have two questions. We'll be quite short. So the steering committee with whom you've been working has been the steering committee.
Andy needs to speak up. We got a mower in the background.
Okay. The steering committee that you've been working with, is that the steering committee of the strategic plan, or?
I understand it's a bit different. It's a different group.
And then moving forward, how do you foresee yourself working with, I guess, different members of the campus community to adapt and respond? And, like, how often would this take place? Who would these stakeholder groups be taking?
Yeah. So there's a slide that follows a little bit that kind of talks about our project plan. But on the front end, we're engaging heavily with the academic leadership to ensure that they're understanding what we're doing and incorporating their feedback. And then from there, we move forward and start to kind of continue to broaden the engagement to research units and central support units and the department. We're still kind of fairly in the first half or so of the project, but a lot more stakeholder engagement.
The adaptation and response, so that would sort of come, would it be like an annual basis, or?
In terms of kind of adapting the model to changing conditions. Yeah, the best practice that I've seen is that the University of Bloomington, they actually put together a committee every 5 years. They kind of come together and evaluate the model. And they say, are we still staying true to our guiding principles? And they actually put out a report every 5 years. And by and large, they operate under a decentralized form of budget. They stay very true to that. They've made some changes at the margins to reflect that IU is a different institution today than it was in, I think, 1990 when they moved to the model. But that's a practice that we would recommend. We suggest that whatever incentives and principles you put in place, you keep it consistent for at least several years, because you don't want the rules to change every year. That makes it difficult for leadership to kind of do long-term planning, which is really what we want to incentivize in this type of a model. Not just looking at the next 9 months, but looking out the next 4 to 5 years.
Well, I'm sorry. I sort of want to go back to, you showed us a list of universities. And, I mean, these principles sound all wonderful and they sound good, but the devil is always in the detail. So can you elaborate a little bit on, suppose the university switches to such a thing. So how would you measure that this is successful? That's question one. And question two is, yes, there's an impressive list of universities, but does it happen that, for example, the university adopts such a model and then decides after a couple of years to notice with a failure and changes? So what is your track record of success in the long term working with clients?
Yeah, I'd say to answer the first question, I think in terms of how do you measure success, I think in large part it really goes back to these guiding principles. And this is kind of one of the key roles of the steering committee to ensure that whatever alternative model the university comes up with, that it embodies these guiding principles and it continues to do so on a go-forward basis. In terms of the other question, I've seen a couple examples of universities that have moved towards more of a aggressive, kind of market-driven, is every tub on its own bottom type of model, only to kind of retreat from that years later to move towards more of a balanced approach between local and central role. So that's the couple instances come to mind where universities have kind of gone too far to the right, so to speak, and come back to kind of a more balanced. What WKU is contemplating is more that balanced approach where, again, more authority and responsibility to deans, but also with working with strong collaboration kind of with such a leadership.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Tim.
So, as to follow up on Regent Ernst's comment, devil's in the details, and we talked about being transparent and very collaborative, but at this point it's still, I think, that transparency and collaboration is very limited to the RAMP group itself, if I'm not mistaken. There's not many people outside of that who really know the details of this. You know, I myself still have some questions on, you know, we talk about revenue generating areas and things, but we've got a lot of areas of the university that don't generate revenue but are critical to what we do. But so does the transparency that we're talking about and all that take place once the RAMP committee has come up with their plan, and then we learn more about it at that point? That may not be more for you, maybe more for Anderson. But how does that work? What does that look like, since it doesn't feel real transparent at the moment?
I understand. We've talked about a straw model that would not be in our best interest in this preliminary stage to present it any more than that, because it the deans and others that are trying to help shape a draft. But let me give you some indication of what's going to be unfolding. Early in May, we're going to have an open forum on campus, probably a lot of this material as well. In early June, we're going to have panel discussions. One of the variables that you would fully understand is change is difficult. It's causing, just talking about it is making people anxious. So we're going to bring in a panel of universities that have successfully moved to this type of model and had three different groups. I can't remember how we're exactly structuring it, but three different opportunities to interact with everything from a provost to a chief financial officer. What did you learn from this process in your campus? How is it working? In June, there's going to be a dean's retreat. There may be a slight break in July for some people to be gone. And then we'll gear up in August. So I don't know exactly how this engagement will hold out, but yes, it will be increasingly broad audiences at the same time as small groups back to the business officers to say, what does this mean to you specifically?
And there are faculty and staff that are involved in all of this.
Absolutely. It will go back to University Senate again, Budget Council again, and we won't be successful if we don't have broad participation in this process.
And was there a meeting yesterday?
Budget Council and University Senate Finance and Budget Committee. And some great comments yesterday that we'll through any of these discussions, take back to the steering committee. For example, one faculty member said, I try to act in the best interest of the student, and I believe that student belongs over in a different college. I'm going to help facilitate them to be successful in another college. Well, why would I do that if my college is going to lose money? So, people are thinking about how do you incentivize the right behavior in the interest of a student and not be so driven by what are the financial implications to your own college.
Pretty good question.
And my question centers around picking up on some of the comments that Regents really has made in others. At what point does the Board of Regents become a stakeholder in this discussion of identifying participating in the identification and coordination? I know some of that will be developed under the strategic plan, but as I'm listening to you, it sounds like the budget model and the strategic plan are on parallel tracks, but not necessarily that they meet at some point. And so I don't hear the Board of Regents becoming a participant in this process.
If I may, I think the place where this conversation comes together and is the architect of all this stuff, what we want to ensure occurs is that, number one, we don't overload different portions of the organization. And so keeping separated strategic planning and budgeting made sense at the outset, but what you're going to feel as a board is a coming together. And so this summer, both the budget model and the strategic plan will be an important component of our Board of Regents retreat. And so we'll spend some significant time talking about how you see them aligning, what the campus has brought forward, and the goal is to have, again, the stuff baked enough where it makes good sense strategically. Yeah, there is strong alignment, but not completely baked, so there's the opportunity to shift it and fine-tune it and make sure that it's where the board wants to go. I think the challenge is wanting to get down into the level of detail when you talk about the model, right? So how does the model shift priorities, align resources with those priorities? What are those priorities? Balancing that with staying at the strategic level. So we're going to try to keep those two things appropriately separate.
If we can go ahead, because I'm going to be conscious of time here.
Yes.
And I know that Ann just made a comment about timing, so you may be able to go through that.
All right. I think I'll this is the next to last slide, so I'll kind of wrap up here. This speaks to just a high-level project plan for kind of what we're calling phase one. And so this just shows kind of the beginning of the project in late January, kind of through the end of this phase one in mid-June. This red bar kind of represents where we are right now. And so we've just kind of structured this slide to account for kind of different work streams or kind of sets of activities. So very early on, we did this current state assessment. That's where we went out and met with a number of stakeholders to get a sense of their current perspectives on budgeting as it operates today, and what's working well, and of what's not working well, where is there opportunity for improvement. So we want to be mindful of what works well in the current model. We want to be able to carry that forward in any new model. Where there's pain points as it relates to the new model, we want to make sure any new model addresses those pain points. So we spent a significant amount of time on the front end talking with lots of folks. Data review, we collected all the financial and institutional data we'll be using in the model, and then kind of focused our model build here. Essentially what we've done is create this kind of budget model prototype that allows us to run all kinds of different versions and scenarios in the model, sensitivity analysis, and then we start our stakeholder engagement. This is going to continue on into phase two, but we're engaging folks, we're talking to them about different concepts and ideas, we're getting their feedback, and we're incorporating that in future iterations of the model. So it's a very iterative process along the way. Kind of see these two things running in parallel, you know, engaging stakeholders and then refining the model based on what we're hearing from them. We're also running in parallel some model training as it relates to central budget staff who have responsibility for kind of operating the model on a go-forward basis. Phase two, more stakeholder engagement to come. We'll also start to broaden the stakeholder engagement. We'll also do things around kind of infrastructure development, help the university think through administrative structures, governance structures, what kind of tools and data will you need to really operationalize this once the model is at a state where you kind of go live. Our best practice is to have some kind of a hold harmless or parallel process whereby as you're still being funded according to the way things work today, you have the benefit of seeing what the new world would have looked like had you been in it, even though you're not. And so that gives leadership time to kind of adapt their thinking to whatever the new incentives are.
Do we have the technology, most current ability to share this data? As you use the word training, are we training on an old platform, or is our platform being robust? And is it robust enough for us to do a particular deep dive on these things? In other words, once you finish your work, will that translate to the platform that we have available to us on this campus? And specifically, do we have the budget funds allocated to make sure that this goes forward? Well, there's a lot of humor there. I didn't know what
I'm happy to take the question. We have a good the financial enterprise resource planning system is a good one, and so it's allowed us to kind of download and extract data.
Ours.
Correct.
Yes.
Some universities choose to get a kind of what they call an enterprise performance management system that kind of sits on top of the financial system that allows you to do a lot of the modeling, the data analytics on kind of a platform that's shared. I don't believe the university has that. That's something that you could add on that wouldn't require you to change your financial systems. It's just kind of a fold on top. This would allow you to kind of run different scenarios kind of in real time. In productivity software, worksheets like Excel or things like that. But plenty of universities move forward and don't have that enterprise performance management system. So it's just a...
But as our consultant, you suggest that it's a good thing.
That enterprise performance management system?
Yes.
Yeah, it's worked well for a number of institutions.
Thank you.
On such a system, does that give the users, those in the departments, access to the information? They would have access to that.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a shared platform. And when you think about the annual budgeting process, there's certain general revenue streams that are often forecasted by the central budget unit with respect to undergraduate tuition and general state appropriations. But then there's also revenue that's best forecasted at the local unit as it relates to, say, auxiliary sales or gifts and things like that. And so that platform allows both kind of central inputs and local inputs to come together into kind of a comprehensive all-funds budget approach. And that's one of the benefits of an enterprise performance management system, to have that shared platform so you're not necessarily emailing, you know, spreadsheets back and forth to one another. Because there's always the issue about, you know, too many spreadsheets and version control.
So you made a comment earlier that the departments would have access to information about what it would look like if they were operating in a new system. What are these different? And who's managing that process? Is it paper? Is it an email? Is it a spreadsheet?
I think there's a broad spectrum that exists. We did some work at University of North Dakota, and they have what they call an iDashboards platform, and particularly related to the activity level metrics. It allows the department chair to kind of go in and drill down on students, credit hours, and success completion rates and square footage, and they can kind of drill down and roll up. And understanding that those activity level metrics are part of the budget process has helped them to kind of develop better plans to ensure that they're well positioned for, you know, the new model. In fact, Anna mentioned earlier about the panelists. We're working right now to try to get a dean from the University of North Dakota to come here to campus to kind of share his perspectives on budget redesign and what recommendations he have for other institutions.
I'm still not sure if my question is answered. How am I going to get it today?
Okay. And sorry to be somewhat evasive, but we need to address this in the second phase of the project. Where we are now is highly dependent on exceptionally talented individuals in IT and in institutional research to generate the data centrally. So we still have to make decisions how we have a system called data analytics. How do we allow a dean in the department to have a more decentralized access to data? So we don't have a good answer yet, but we invest in the next 6 months.
This is really just kind of I apologize, it's kind of hard to see, but this is just an expansion of the project plan before, where we called out some of the steering committee meetings, and then, you know, the coloring didn't come through, but this is intended to kind of show different phases of the work as we're talking with deans and panel events and things like that. So again, this is just representative of phase one in June, and mentioned that kind of phase two begins shortly thereafter.
Are we looking at running parallel systems starting July 1? Be ready for that?
I'm not sure that's achievable, but we will sometime in the fall start doing that.
Do backup and data from July 1.
We have to be sensitive to new leadership coming in and not having them come in as if the decisions have been made. So we're carefully balancing that, so I'm not exactly sure that we will be able to do it July 1, but I know that they'll be able to see a parallel before we start developing the 1920 budget. We're probably going to have some internal discussions as to, if you do this on an aggressive timeline, you could have some unintended consequences. So we're going to have to evaluate that. He hasn't heard this, but we might have to do parallel for today. A parallel system a little later. We're just going to have to evaluate what some of those issues.
That concludes my presentation. So again, I appreciate the time.
One question I'd probably like to direct to you. Is that I'm kind of going to go for Regent Dickens' question, and that is, the board will have the opportunity to engage in policy decisions. What we think the right approach may be, one way or the other. So we're a part of that function as well.
Absolutely. I think that there's a place where...
You think this is important, we don't think this is important, which may be different from somebody else.
Yeah, I think the way we'll, my understanding of the way we'll move through is through the Budget and Finance Committee first, and then bring that to the whole board. But I think that as it gets more concrete, that's the place where we start to engage with the board as well.
Which but the concrete won't set till such time.
That's exactly right. Concrete won't set till apparently sometime in the mid-fall, as I'm learning today. So,
George?
One other question. And I apologize for being late. So maybe you come to this. But this is a huge undertaking. And there are a lot of systems issues, a lot of organizational issues. Is there a plan or someone looking at the risk perspective of this? So I got a plan. I know what I want to do, and I'm going to try to execute it, because I got all this stuff that's going to be in that. And I just worry about, from an operational risk perspective, what are we doing? This, you know, and so you mentioned the University of North Dakota. That's great. They can tell us the value that something gets, but I'd actually like to know not just the pain points for people who are going on the system, but what are the things I got to watch for to make sure that I'm progressing the way I want to. And so that's the, when I read through this, that's the part I didn't really get, that we have that operational risk plan behind us, because this thing could fall apart not because we don't have a good plan, but, and not that we didn't execute well. So I just didn't hear that part. I was curious if you thought about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a kind of core part of the kind of phase two as it relates to kind of putting forth an implementation plan and kind of following it. One of the values of the parallel process is that it provides the institution time to kind of build that infrastructure. And it's critical such that you're not in the old world on a Friday and the new world on a Monday, and people don't know what to expect. And there are some institutions that have chosen to kind of extend that parallel process a little bit until they feel like the infrastructure is in place such that the campus units can be successful in the new environment. And that comes with tools, policy changes, structure, a whole host of things, ensuring that people understand the incentives, the implications of those incentives, and they feel like, they see a path forward to be successful. And so that's all kind of part of what we'll lay out in phase two, and then we'll be monitoring accordingly. Are we on pace? Are there any unexpected issues that are arising? And if so, how does that impact our ability to kind of go live, so to speak?
Could you suggest anything that we could do or the administration could do that would maybe tone down the anxiety of this process? Now that we've gone through it several times, obviously there are things that that we would not know until we're finished. That would be, there are certain departments that have more anxiety about this because of they're not in the middle of, the business college might understand it, but another college might have a less of an understanding. And is there any suggestions you could make that we could do to lower the anxiety level so that the success could happen at a real positive pace?
Yeah. I think from Huron's experience, cannot overstate the importance of stakeholder engagement and meeting with people again and again across functions and groups. And the panel event as well, helping hear is one thing to, hear it from a consultant. It's another thing to hear it from institutional leaders at other places in terms of what was there. So if they were to do it all over again, what would they do differently and why?
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
It was a very good presentation. Okay, we go to a little bit shorter information item, and that's the report that was presented on page F5 of the materials sent to you.
Oh, no, mine's going to be really long to you.
I knew.
I didn't even do a presentation, so we're good. I do want to say while it's on your mind right now, because Regent Nichols mentioned the word risk, I was back here going, yes. Let's talk about that. So I wanted to talk about the third leg of the things that we're discussing, the things that we're changing, the strategic planning process that we're developing, and also the budget model being transitioned to a new model possibly. So So the third leg is the enterprise risk management process that we talked about, and we're trying to build that up here on the, at the university. And so that's where one of my announcements today comes in. Right now we're kicking off the risk assessment that we do annually. So I want to say to the leadership group that these things that we're talking about when we're developing the strategic plan, when we're talking about the new budget model, that should be on the forefront of your mind when we're discussing what risks are out there, because what's going to hinder us from reaching the goal that we're putting in that strategic plan or being able to do the budget model in a way that is successful. So that's one of the announcements. You should have gotten an email this morning while you're sitting here from Julie over there. She sent out the risk assessment that's your part for the Finance and Budget Committee members. So we're asking for your input for that risk assessment. And we do that every year. I don't know if you remember getting that same thing last year. And if you do have any questions about that, you contact me or email me or give me a phone call. So you should have that. It's a very short survey where we're asking about what your thoughts are, what your expertise, your knowledge, just in the area of the university itself, but also industry-wide, what things are out there that you know about that could impact Dedicate. So that's actually going to be my last announcement, but it worked out really well. Thank you for that. I do have just a couple of things to talk about. This quarter, we completed just two projects. And the first one, and it's on your information item, so that's kind of what I'm going through today. Stealth Check Recovery Process Audit. Just so you know, that one was not on the audit plan as part of the risk assessment we did last year. It was actually just a management request so that we could get into get some more insight into the process of the Stealth Check Recovery Process, which basically is when WKU cuts a check to an employee or vendor or contractor, whoever the payee may be. And what happens after that leaves the university and that person receiving the check doesn't process it any further, so they don't cash it, they don't deposit it. That happens. I never do that. My checks that I get, I always cash them. So we walked through that process, and we ended up having three recommendations from that, and they were all considered low rated, basically because it was a management request. There wasn't a lot of risk there that was involved in that process. But it was a good way to educate and get into the more depth of that process. The other project is the NCAA football ticket reconciliation. We do that on an annual basis. And that is where we are making sure we're in compliance with the NCAA bylaw 20.9.93. And we are required to, on average, have 15,000 of paid attendance at all of home games for two rolling seasons, so we look at that on a two-year basis. And for this year, we are in compliance. If you look at season 16, season 17, we were able to have, on average, more than that 15,000 requirement in paid attendance. And that project usually results in just a memo that goes out to our athletic director, and they keep those records for NCAA purposes. Other things on your information item are things that are currently in progress. So we have a lot that's been drafted, lots of reports out there that we're either waiting to do the exit conference or we're waiting on action plans for management for those. And those will be coming up soon and be issued hopefully sooner than later. And then, of course, things that are still either in a planning stage or an execution stage where we still need to work on that. That is my whole report, short and sweet.
Ready?
This might be just directed to the committee. I had asked for that thing on the engineering issue that we had with funding the funds, and I don't know what was going to do with this one.
Well, that you did mention that to me. Probably is something that should be discussed.
I can give you a small update on that. Do you want that now?
Well, here's my concern. My concern is that to the extent that it would have to be in a closed session because of the nature of what occurred, we're probably not permitted legally to discuss it in an open session. Now, I mean, I don't mind calling them, but we have
constraints. Again, I don't know the context, so I can't. I have to trust somebody's judgment.
at the end of this committee meeting, we're going to have a special meeting notice for the next time. Perhaps we could put it on that agenda. Andy?
I just had a quick question about one of the... So, regarding the ethics and compliance hotline, it says that two cases are under preliminary review. Did the other 21 cases just not meet standards to review, or was it an issue of volume?
No, those other ones, we've already been doing that for a while.
Okay.
Those have been closed.
Okay.
Based on our findings. With that, when they come in, we do preliminary review, and we try to keep that kind of, we don't want to announce, hey, you've been recorded.
Right.
So it's kind of harder to do when we're doing it that way.
Yeah.
But we don't want to cause a stir if it's not necessary. But yeah, the rest of those have been closed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
All right, thank you.
Rapidly moving down now to the last information item. This is information for debt management report. Now this material, in the interest of time, this material has been sent out to everyone previously. I hope everybody's had a chance to read it. And Ann, I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Yes, we did get the committee homework with the intent that you do all this reading, studying, and bring back great questions that the expert to my right, Mr. Mark Rawlings, Vice President with Hilliard Lyons, will be able to answer. But in joking, I'll participate if I can. You know, we've taken debt management a lot more seriously by creating a university policy and by creating a debt management advisory committee with individuals from across the campus. And first, let me tell you, I'm not sure how your copy came out when you printed it. We gave you a copy of the debt management report, and my copy had draft on it. It was draft to the debt management advisory committee, not to this board. So we're not expecting you to take any actions today. The debt management report provides an update on the rating agencies' reviews, our current ratings. It gives you selected financial ratios that are monitored by the debt management advisors. And with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Mark and see what questions you may have about this report.
Did we want to put the presentation?
We can put the slides up if Jeff, and if there are any questions, these would be the ones that are at the end where Mark would show you where we are in terms of our rating on Moody's and Standards and Poor's, the financial ratios. And the last one was a comparison from the financial reports about our outstanding debt in comparison to benchmark universities, and a calculation of our debt as an amount per FTE student. So if you would like to reference one of those slides, please let us know and we'll go to it.
Well, I'll start with the committee. David, Jason, Brady, Chuck. Do you have any questions that you going
time.
Through this? I know you all got it earlier. So that's good. All right, anyone else? Class up.
I have a couple of questions. The first question is on page 6 of that standard and tourist rating thing. It talks about our full-time equivalent students in that table there. I was wondering if there's a misprint. There's 17,601 for 2017. That seems not quite the correct number.
What are you talking about? Here.
We may have a data error in the Standard & Poor's report, which indicates that our FTE enrollment for fall of 16 was 17,601. So we're following up. Normally we get the draft report and didn't catch that before it was published.
Can I follow up with a similar question? I don't know if you're the right person to ask questions about the ratios,
sure,
which are computed. So I would like to see more information in the sense of
what, where the actual number is going into these ratios. So to give you an example of the primary reserve ratio, claim versus or our deficit policy, this is sort of an assessment of the financial health. And I sort of see that this number has increased actually quite dramatically. And certainly for me, as a faculty member on the ground, to think that the institution has gotten financially healthier in the last 3 years seems somewhat contrary to my experience. The second thing I sort of wondering is as follows. The denominator of this ratio is quite large. And so I'm not sure how these ratios can fluctuate so much. Okay, and so that's where I would like to have more explanation. So my intuitive feeling would be we have basic measurement of financial health, and we take out the retirement issue which the state sort of forces us to keep track of in some sense. Then if I look at the my experience, raised roughly, we have a slight enrollment decline, but these quantities should change by 10-20%, but I can't see how they suddenly triple. Okay, and so the fluctuation is way larger an order of magnitude than I would expect. And so if these things fluctuate that much, then I'm wondering if they're actually the right ratios to measure in the first place. So that's a very complicated set of questions.
Well, I think we certainly can provide you with the hard numbers that went into each of these calculations. I would probably look to Ann or Jim to actually explain why they think, you know, this particular ratio, again, as you've indicated, to back out the impact of pension obligations. It's simply expendable net assets divided by total expenses. We generally think that, you know, an improving ratio on this one is a very good indicator, as you would expect. But I take it you're skeptical that it actually has been borne out.
As our previous conversation, we don't have the data today, but we're going to provide it to you so you can see the mathematical calculations that are drawn from our financial reports that result in these ratios.
And I would, you know, indicate that both rating agencies as well have indicated that the university's operations on a full cash basis, so on taking out the pension liabilities, are very strong and have been positive. I think both rating reports indicate as much, and they view that as a credit positive. However, it's when you roll in the pension obligations that things start to look a little more dour, and they note that it's both a credit strength and a credit weakness. So I think certainly we can provide you with the numbers that went into these calculations, and then I think you'll agree that, you know, they are correct. And you know, it's whether you want to look at it on a cash basis or on a full accrual basis.
If I recall, I've been on the board about 6 years this year. That was not actually, to Klaus's point, there may be a change of how we calculated that, because at one time we didn't have that obligation. It was not. And it was like all of a sudden, 1 year in our financial reporting, it completely shifted. I don't know if someone can help my memory.
It was GASB 68. It was a new accounting standard that went into place in 2015.
Well, and that not that there is an error in the numbers, but there could have been a different way that we reported it. Because if I recall, that was a big issue, because the year that it was announced, we backtracked to try to figure out how that was. We did not necessarily change those numbers.
Well, and that's correct, but to Dr. Ernst's point, we backed out those numbers from this calculation.
So this is a net-net then. Okay. Our discussion was that it was an unfunded mandate. I mean, the whole thing centered around it was an unfunded mandate. We had no idea it was going to be there, and then all of a sudden it showed up, and so that caused our balance sheet to be all out.
Right. It, you know, if you look at it just on the face of it, it makes it look like the university is massively underwater.
Right.
Which isn't the case, obviously. If it were, you know, we'd have to shut the doors, but... on a cash basis, things have been positive.
Right. And Moody's, and just to make this comment and see if you agree or disagree, Moody's and S&P and rating agencies agree with that analysis.
Yes.
There, as this board has heard from previous rating reports, there's obviously a very strong analytical process for the rating agencies, but we go through an extensive discussion looking at who's our management, how long have they been here, how are we addressing student retention and recruitment, what's going on with our private giving activity. And the rating agencies look at the Student Life Foundation, the WKU Foundation, College Heights Foundation, all of us collectively to come out with these ratings. And the fact that they had us as stable and positive ratings assures people of our, should we have a decision by this board and authorization for the state to issue bonds, that we are in good financial condition to honor those obligations.
That's the whole purpose of the rating. Identify the risk, and they're saying
certainly more than just four ratios. While it's sometimes easier to want to have an analytical approach to issuing debt or not, we've got a very good relationship with these rating agencies that spend time understanding WKU.
And I do want to reiterate one point, you know, as the rating agencies look at the creditworthiness of the university, they are generally very comfortable with the financial state of the university. But typically the credit challenges for WKU are that it is a little highly leveraged compared to other comparably rated universities. That means that the amount of debt that you have is a little bit higher than other comparable universities in the same rating category. So that is a credit negative. But they are very comfortable, on the flip side of that, with the financial well-being of the university. And they haven't generally expressed concerns that the university is going to run out of money, anything like that. It's, you know, they try to look at the university within certain criteria for each rating category. And then they also compare you to other universities within that rating category and see how you stack up. So the university fares favorably on a financial basis, but you're a little highly leveraged compared to other universities.
Mr. Rawlings, would you comment, and this may be more than what we need to hear today, but in a raising interest rate environment that we see ourselves in economically in the country and within the market, financing debt at a low interest rate should have a favorable effect on us going forward. Or if our debt is financed at a very low interest rate, Moody's looks at our balance sheet, it would be much better than if we would have waited some time to finance this debt at a higher rate, so to speak. So does that have an influence also on their...
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, I temper that with, we've been saying that interest rates are going to go up for about 8 years. Yeah. And they really haven't until really this year. But generally, you're right. I mean, you know, expectations for interest rates are they can't stay at these pretty historically low rates forever. They're going to go up at some point. So, you know, waiting, you run the risk of interest rates increasing. You also run the risk of projects just becoming more expensive. So those are two pretty big things to consider when determining whether or not to go forward with the project.
Philosophically, I understand that you have these rating agencies, but I believe the decision to actually engage in any more debt or bonds should be separated from this. And I then think it should be driven by the fact that these are ratings such that we can sustain it. I think it ought to be a separate decision, independent of what these rating agencies tell us.
Well, in the rating agencies, so they have two functions. One, they provide an annual review of the university's credit because you have bonds outstanding. They would also be engaged to gauge the creditworthiness of a project that the university had already decided to pursue. So we're not sitting around waiting for the rating agencies to say, now's a good time to do it because your rating is strong. they're providing a service actually to bondholders. It's a very unusual relationship because the university pays them, but they are beholden to people who actually own the bonds because they're telling them this is the creditworthiness of the university. But we engage them to give us that feedback when we think it's time to proceed with the project.
Let me correct the myth. If there's one thing, grading agencies don't drive decisions from the university. Never had. As long as I've been here, they never had. And I've never seen a debt that this university has that's never been driven by that decision. So I think that would be wrong to assume that, because quite simply, you're right. They are there to protect the bondholders, the purchasers of the bonds.
And just a comment. This has been very helpful. I've read those reports, and I feel like you can imagine an organization that runs this financial investor, right? Towards being in the financial services world. But the cause's point, I think, is from a fiduciary standpoint, we as a board make sure that the faculty, staff, students, that where we are in our financial picture today, where that we're stable, we put credit risk, but we do have to address the pension, which the president's doing. And we do have to address the fact that we are overleveraged. And so I think for us, we probably should be in a position at some point in the future, we should be able to explain to people how we're going to manage it. I know that you work on it from a pension standpoint. We have to manage, yeah, we can cover what there were over leverage. But I know there's been issues around what we're going to build. Are we going to build something else on the campus and so forth? But I think we have a responsibility to say this is how we're going to manage the university from a financial perspective, based on what we know and how we make independent decisions from this spot, plus what we get from the rating agencies. So I think you're raising a point that people want to know, what are you going to do? And I think that's the issue that we should make sure we're dealing with. And I think we are, from what I know now. But that's the way I look at it. This is a report, but yeah, we'll answer the pension and we'll answer the long-term budget issue. We should be doing that. That's what we're responsible for.
Well, I agree with what you say, George. I think there's two elements, two factors in that. One is, do we have and do we manage an overall policy, period? And then number two, you look at, oh, wait a minute, we've got a project coming in, so you do it on a single basis. And then you have to take that overall policy and make sure it applies on a case-by-case basis, but you start at the top with the policy. And we have to bury that policy in with what the state requires us to do, what the statutes require us to do. And we've got, to issue bonds. Sometimes we have to be in a position we have to secure state approval. Sometimes CPE approval, if we're talking about fees, student fees, and that sort of thing. We've got compliance with the debt policy. We've got a committee that reviews that. And then we've got ratios. And we look at the debt reports that you just made. Now we look at all of that. Now we apply it to the project down here that we just now want to talk about. This is hypothetical, almost as we consider that. And the board then has to take that and make that final approval. So there are a lot of checkpoints off.
And I think that's an important thing that we've got to articulate to those outside of this group. And we do manage that process. And again, when I look at it, that was sort of where I migrated to, is how do we manage through the process and make people feel confident that we're making good, sound policy decisions on behalf of the financial position of the university. But I think you're asking the right questions, but I think we're doing that. We probably need to do a better job so that people feel comfortable and that we are responding to their issues and questions.
Well, I think the fact that you guys are having these conversations at all speaks very highly to the responsibility of this board and that you take your fiduciary responsibility very seriously. Not all institutions have these types of conversations. Not all institutions have a debt policy at all. That speaks highly to the university of this board, and it's not unrecognized either by the rating agency when they do start talking about the university's credit.
Okay. Mark, thank you for coming down here.
Absolutely. Always glad to come back to this.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
And do we have Frank Miller maybe to explore the kind of thought what we meant to do today?
Yes. Thank you for the note.
Will you let Brad know? We thank you.
He told me he was going to order. Thank you. So Brad Wheeler, everybody, just, you know, Brad Wheeler. Because he's going to give me some alumni merchandise if I kill him and kill myself too.
Make sure it happens. Mr. Chair, that's all.
Yeah, Mark, thank you very much. Appreciate you taking the time to do this. Okay, that concludes with one announcement that I would like to make from the Finance and Budget Committee. We would like to schedule a special meeting of the Finance and Budget Committee on May the 11th before the regular board meeting for the purpose of making the presentation of information to the budgets. So, really, whatever, we get those times set, you know, it'd be sometime in the morning before our regular meeting.
I'm sorry, I just walked in.
A special meeting of the Finance and Budget Committee on May the 11th, which will be preparation for the June meeting. If I said that correctly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sunrise Service.
Sunrise Service, that's exactly right. No, that's it.
Okay, well, thank you. I think Mark made a great comment when he said just having these discussions is valuable for the public to see and for us to engage in. So I find myself more thankful to have the people around the board that we do who understand finances and who are asking some great questions for CPAs, lawyers, mathematicians, and I think that's a great collection of people and thoughts. So with that, we're going to take about a 10-minute break. We'll come back and conclude the rest of our meeting. 5-minute break, okay. We'll be back at 10:15.